Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are prominent Republican pollster Whit Ayers and the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library, Lindsay Chervinsky. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Now, before we get started, get out your calendars. Get them out right now. We have exciting news. James and I are taking Politics War Room on tour. So come see us live at the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th with Senator Bill Bradley, NBA great, and has a wonderful documentary. Be a fascinating conversation. In Atlanta on October 12th, Atlanta, that is, at the Variety Playhouse, or Boston's Schubert Theater on November 2. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. Now get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com and tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Mint Mobile, and 3-Day Blinds. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. All right, James, we have a really interesting guest, Whit Ayers, Republican pollster, coming up to talk about the state of the race and all that. But there are a number of things that happened. I mean, the Arlington Cemetery incident, despite Trump's effort to lie about it and get people to lie for him, hasn't gone away. He really did stomp on hallowed ground. And it was interesting that this week, Jimmy McCain, a 17-year veteran and the son of John McCain, came out for Kamala Harris and said and noted that he has three ancestors, his father, his grandfather, and his great-grandfather, who are buried at Arlington. And it was outrageous that Donald Trump treated hallowed ground that way. I didn't think it was going to become a big issue. I don't think it's going to become a defining issue, but I don't think it's going to go away either.
Well, okay, I think we ought to leave it alone. Not that it's not a disgrace. It is. He's already said this. Soldiers are suckers. Why would anybody do that? And his voters don't care. And that you said, look, the families wanted this. And every minute you're talking about that, you're not talking about his abortion vote in Georgia.
That's true.
Right. I mean, look, is it an outrage? But there's been so many outrages that don't matter, that any other person couldn't remotely sustain this. No other person would actually say, would tell General Kelly that soldiers are suckers, or would say that their son's gravesite. So of all of the egregious things that he's done vis-a-vis the military, this is kind of medium. But we got him on the run on this Florida vote, and he doesn't like it. And we got to be careful not to go for new shiny things here. Now, I know it's outrage, and people should be outraged about it, but that's not where we're going to win this election. We're going to win this election on the whole question of, you know, reproductive rights.
I think you're right, but I think I still think there is a second tier basket, if you will, not just of Arlington, but of Arlington telling his own chief of staff that fallen soldiers were suckers and losers, demeaning John McCain, who was a war hero, and saying the other day that, you know, really Medal of Honor winners, they're dead. Right. So, you know, that's not, I think you put that all together. It's not like abortion. It's not like Project 2025. It's not like trying to overturn an election. But I think I think selectively, you know, it still could be useful.
Maybe they can do a day with national security, all the ex-admirals and generals and shit. But remember, in politics, to do one thing is not to do another. And that's the hard thing, because say if we just do one more thing. And I it's a great question for him at the debate. I'm sure he'll get it. But I just think we got him.
And I don't know what the rules are, James, because you know he'll lie about it. And the question is it going to be the last debate?
No, if she has some good jokes, as I said today, one joke is worth 100 fact checks. It doesn't matter. Yeah. He now knows that he drives with impunity. But
right.
he he is really caught on this Florida thing. I mean, really caught, really uncomfortable. And boy, this thing is so good, because when they accuse Harris of flip-flopping from her 2020 presidential campaign, she can just point right to this. Easy. This is a
golden... he says, A, it ought to be a state issue. And when he has a chance in a place where he votes, he has sided with a six-week abortion ban.
Yes, correct.
That is all the above is indisputable.
That's correct. And it's indisputable that this is the best issue that the Democrats have had maybe in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And don't get too distracted here. That'd be my message.
The numbers show Kamala Harris surging in the South and putting Trump on the defensive. Right now, it looks like her biggest opportunity may lie in Georgia. How important would a win there be, James?
Well, it's critical. And you got seven states. And, you know, Georgia, you won by 11,000 votes. It's actually Virginia, the two southern states that have two Democratic senators, but not by very much. And but if you ask me, you know, what's more important, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Arizona, it's like asking you what child's better, okay? They're all really critical, but Georgia is at the first rank. And the other thing is that the Atlanta metropolitan area is a huge percent of the voters in Georgia, and it's decidedly Democratic, and we have to do very, very well if we're going to win that.
It may look close, but Harris has a secret weapon. James and I are taking Politics War Room on the road to Atlanta for a live show on October 12th at the Variety Playhouse. We're going to rally the troops, host a special guest as they try to turn Georgia blue. Now, how much are you looking forward to seeing our listeners there, James?
I'm really looking forward to it, and I'll promise our listeners this. If you come out, we'll do something. We'll come up with some new ideas and maybe some new attacks and some new things to think about so we can all get excited. I love going to Atlanta. I think this thing is going to be really, really successful. I think we'll have a really special guest of people. And for sure, it's, you know, right as, you know, coming down the home stretch of the election. And I can't imagine that there's a Democrat in Atlanta Metro that doesn't want to come to this, because it's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And I want you to come to this incredible show that we're going to have in Georgia at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, October 12th. Now, don't wait. The tickets are going fast, and we want to see as many of you there as we can. So please head to politicon.com/tour. That's politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. The road to the White House will start now.
Absolutely. Come and see us in Hotlanta.
Let me try one more, and that's Bibi Netanyahu, who I think there's no doubt that Bibi Netanyahu has no interest in some kind of a truce, which I think the majority of Israelis favor, the IDF favors. His supporter, wouldn't have many of these weapons without the Americans. And I think Biden has tried to say he's not doing enough. I think Harris can go further. I think, you know, basically, you know, you have to, I agree, I'm not anti-Israel, I'm quite pro-Israel, she can say. I agree with your defense minister, I agree with your former prime ministers, I agree with the IDF, I agree with the majority of Israeli citizens. If you don't go to the table now and negotiate a truce, it's going to affect American support for you.
Well, understand how much financial support the United States has given the state of Israel. Right? Right. It's since Camp David, the Iron Dome, the munitions, the everything. And Netanyahu says, "We own our country. Fine, pay your own way." I mean, that might be too startling for some people, but the idea that the United States government doesn't have a right to recommend policies to the state of Israel, and the United States government has every expectation that the state of Israel will not do things to harm the interests of the United States, because the United States has funded, I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars in every kind of thing that you can imagine. The trade that we have with Israel is robust, and it's, as it well should be. But we have some leverage here that we can exercise, and I don't know if we need to say it public right away, but you can certainly dispatch our ambassador or, you know, the Secretary of State, say, hey, look, dude, this is the way the cow ate the cabbage. We're going to have a serious talk here. And
James, you can, but he won't listen. He has two interests. He wants to stay in power and avoid jail. And secondly, he wants to help Donald Trump. Because if Donald Trump's elected, he feels the pressure is off.
I agree. But also, the people of Israel are very sensitive about their relationship with the United States.
Right.
And you just got to bring some meat. But it's just true. You know, if you want to do this extemporaneous wild man crap, you do it on your own dime. They can't do it. That's where you got leverage to get their attention.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. James, we're going to have Whit Ayers on in a few minutes, but anything else you want to talk about before we move on?
Well, you know, I still think that this debate on September 10th is going to be a huge event. And I think ABC is doing everything they can to try to keep it alive. I think you don't know what he's going to do till the morning of September 10th. He could just decide that he's not going to do it. You can see that he's torn, and she just can exhibit. I'm showing up. It was a contract. We said we'd be there. I believe in honoring your obligations. And he's got he's in a tight spot here. He doesn't want to do this. He wants to get out of it, but he doesn't quite know how, and he's scared that he might need it to, you know, get a little bit mojo back. So this thing has got a lot of questions left to answer here.
I agree. He wants to get out. He'll be there. He has no choice.
I think you're right. Yeah. But he doesn't. It's the one thing we know. His advisors ain't got anything to say about it. I mean, his chief, not new advisor on women's issues, is Corey Lewandowski, and they have something in common. Both of them are adjudicated sexual harassers or molesters or something like that.
Well, I'm sure they're comfortable with each other.
Totally.
Okay. We will keep on this. Hey, James, our guest has long been one of America's premier political pollsters, Whit Ayers, who is the founder and president of North Star Opinion Research. There is no more respected Republican pollster than Whit Ayers. Whit, first of all, thanks for being with us.
Al, great to be with you and great to be with James. I've always found him one of the most entertaining people out there, and you one of the most insightful.
Well, certainly James has never been dull, and he's also insightful, but with too much to go, Whit, tell us what you think is the state of the presidential race today.
I think it is what everyone obviously says it is, and that is basically a dead heat that will boil down to seven critical swing states that are also a dead heat. Kamala Harris has had a remarkable 5 or 6 weeks since Joe Biden got out of the race. Joe Biden had depressed Democratic numbers in polling, and way, way below normal because the vast majority of Democrats, as well as people around the country who are Republicans and independents, thought he was too old to run again. Once he got out of the way and Kamala Harris got in, the polls snapped back to normal. Normal in a polarized, very partisan age means a dead heat, which is what we've got. I think she has run a very good race so far with only one significant error, which we can talk about if you want, or we can go on to something else.
Don't tease us.
We'll talk about it.
What was it?
I think it was a very significant blunder not to put Josh Shapiro on the ticket with her. Josh Shapiro is a wildly popular governor of the most critical swing state and the largest swing state of Pennsylvania with 19 electoral votes. You lose Pennsylvania, you got to make up with two of the other swing states. Instead, she took a popular governor from a state that has not voted for a Republican candidate for president in a half a century. I saw a poll this last week that said that a Harris-Shapiro race would be 6 points ahead of Trump-Vance in Pennsylvania. And so I think it was a major blunder that could cost her the election. She might win in spite of it, but it is a horrible missed opportunity from the perspective of the Harris campaign, in my judgment.
Well, I certainly thought she should have picked Shapiro, still do. But Walz has been a much better candidate than I thought he was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good candidate. He seems to be a good guy with good Midwestern values of decency and respect for others. And as a native of Ames, Iowa, I like those small town Midwestern values. But the fact remains that he brings nothing to the table that she didn't already have. And Josh Shapiro could bring the most critical swing state that is currently a toss-up. So to me, it was a no-brainer to pick him, and I, for the life of me, don't understand why she didn't.
Let me ask you this. How important is next Tuesday's Harris-Trump debate, and what does each candidate have to do or hope to do?
Well, I think at this point, you have to say it's critical. Anytime you have a tie race, any significant event has the potential to be critical. It could be a non-event, or it could be a watershed event. And we just don't know. I mean, we think back to the last debate with Joe Biden. Most of us didn't think it was going to be a watershed event, and yet it completely upended the race. What Kamala Harris has to do is come across as a competent and reasonable potential president of the United States. And what Trump has to do is focus his attacks on enormous policy differences between the two, and try to avoid the sort of personal bullying schoolyard antics that so often come out of his mouth. We'll see if he can do it. I know his team wants him to do that. We'll see if he has the discipline to pull it off.
I doubt it, but let me ask one more point. James and I have stressed that the only way that the one-time Republican Party that you knew so well can return to its brand, smaller government, free market, strong national security, Reagan, Bush, Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, is for Trump and Trumpism to suffer a really huge defeat on November 5. Yet there was a fascinating piece a couple days ago in The Bulwark by Jonathan Lass that argues even that wouldn't matter. The Trumpism now is so embedded in the Republican Party, and that nothing in the foreseeable future is going to change that. Your view?
I disagree with Jonathan on that. I think that Donald Trump is sui generis. I think if he is no longer in the picture, there will be others who will try to pick up the mantle. But there's no one out there like Donald Trump. And the people who've tried to pick up the mantle have, for the most part, suffered defeat at the ballot box when they ran for Senate or for governor. So I think it would be a fundamentally different party. It would be a party that would have to marry the more traditional Republicans with the MAGA Republicans. So I don't think we're going back to a Reagan-Bush party, but it's hard to imagine exactly what the party would look like with a fusion of MAGA Republicans and traditional Republicans. But I don't think it's locked into a Trump mindset without Donald Trump to drive it.
James.
So with the, you know, these two campaigns, well, people have these kind of questions, but we would ask people, I'm going to read you two statements. Which one do you mostly agree with? That Donald Trump was a uniquely skilled politician that came on the scene and was able to put together a coalition of people who, xenophobic, were against immigration, that were sort of misogynistic, kind of isolationist foreign policy. And he just brilliantly exploited Republicans around the country to follow him. There's another view by a Senate candidate named Kathy Barnett, who was a black extreme Trumpist candidate in Pennsylvania. She said, you have to understand something. MAGA was here before Trump. He just came in and rented us. And MAGA will be here after Trump. Which of these two statements comes closer to Whit Ayers' view?
Probably the second, but not with the conclusion and the second that the Trumpism is going to dominate the party. Trumpism is basically a populist movement, which is anti. It's anti-establishment, anti-immigrant, anti-press, anti-expertise. And that has been a theme, not just in the Republican Party. I mean, going back to Williams Jennings Bryan and Huey Long were populist politicians. George Wallace was a populist politician in the Democratic Party. But we've had Pat Buchanan giving a speech in 1992, which Donald Trump could have given. And so we've had that element in the Republican Party for a long time. The difference is that a populist had never been elected president before. And that's what really made this difference. So Donald Trump took a theme that was there and magnified it and grew it into the dominant force in the Republican Party. And so I think it's more the second than the first, James.
So there are any number of Republican friends who, you know, say, look, if we ever want to get a somewhat nationalistic, low tax, lighter regulatory touch, more traditional party back, then Trump has to get wiped out. I don't know if that's even possible. And look, Goldwater got wiped out in 64. Republicans came back and won in 68. McGovern got wiped out in 72. The Democrats came back and won in 76. And that's the way that we can purge the party of this rot.
Well, I don't think you're ever going to purge the party of millions of Americans who believe in Donald Trump and believe in his message. Donald Trump will go away eventually. I mean, if he gets elected again, he's going to go away in 2028 because he can't run again. And if he loses, he's going to go away because he will have led Republicans to five straight defeats in 2018, 2020, 2021 in Georgia, and 2022. So he will go away eventually. And then it's going to be an interesting amalgamation, as I said, of the MAGA voters and the more traditional Republicans that'll go forward.
So to turn it back to, I'll just make one point. If Harris wins in 2028, in 20 years, there will only be 4 years of Republican rule.
Right.
And I think the average Republican at that point is going to be open to how do we, and they're going to have Supreme Court appointments and all the shit and foreign policy and all of this stuff. And I just think if Harris wins, the Republican Party is going to be a lot more focused on winning the election in 2028 than they previously.
Well, you're probably right, James. I wrote a whole book about how the Republican Party needs to adapt to a new, more diverse America. And my argument was that the basic principles of free enterprise and individual liberty and strong national defense and a reasonable size but not overweening federal government appeal to people across racial and ethnic lines. Donald Trump, I think, got a hold of that book and decided to do the exact opposite on every one of the recommendations in the book. But I continue to believe that the Republican Party. I continue to believe that the Republican Party needs to and must adapt to a changing America, and that it has the capacity to do that and be victorious.
Okay, Albert.
J.D. Vance is probably off to the roughest start of any vice presidential candidate since Dan Quayle, you know, maybe Sarah Palin. Why? And does it make any difference?
I think that when Donald Trump picked J.D. Vance as his VP, this was before Joe Biden dropped out, and he thought he was picking the MAGA successor for himself, as opposed to someone who could help him win. I'm not sure he would make that same choice today. I suspect someone like Marco Rubio or Doug Burnham maybe would have stood a better chance.
Yeah.
But I think Donald Trump was very, very confident he was going to waltz into the White House when he made that pick. But let's not forget, as you mentioned, Sarah Palin had a really rough rollout.
She did.
I mean, really rough.
She just saw Alaska from her front porch, Whit. I mean, after all.
Now, come on. That was Saturday Night Live.
But that's
it wasn't
memory.
Her line. But you know, you're right. I mean, she had an incredibly rough rollout, and it didn't seem to have that much effect on the election. Although I will say I know plenty of people who wanted to vote for John McCain, but who were resistant for doing so because they didn't want Sarah Palin one heartbeat away from the White House.
Well, my other example, Dan Quayle got a, you know, had a terrible rollout and it didn't make any difference at all. I mean, his opponent as the vice presidential nominee was Lloyd Benson, who got a great rollout, and Bush clobbered Dukakis in Texas. So if Vance were to call you tomorrow and say, okay, what can I do now? 2 months to go, hadn't been very good. Any advice you could give him?
Al, J.D. Vance would never ask for my advice in a million years. But I think you just have to sound like a reasonable person who wants to be president of all Americans, rather than taking pot shots at various people who you don't particularly like. That doesn't go over very well. Yeah. Anytime you criticize someone because of their identity, you offend everyone who shares that identity, whether it's childless cat owners or whoever it is. And so it's a good way to make a whole lot of enemies and not win a lot of friends.
Well, obviously, we love podcasts here, Whit, but J.D.'s problem, too, is he went on too damn many podcasts 4 or 5 years ago and said all kinds of loony things. But, James, go ahead.
So before we go, the polls were not good in 2020. They were Biden went in Wisconsin by 8, Pennsylvania by 7, Michigan by the US, and they were taken late. They said, all right, we learned our lesson in 2016. We're going to poll right. We're going to poll through the end. Now, they were actually dead on in Georgia. Right? But Trump really underpolls. Are y'all, is the industry trying to take something to, or can we have more confidence in polls today than we did 4 years ago?
No, I think so. The whole industry has faced that, James. And I think we're doing a lot more to make sure that we have the proportionate number of non-college whites in our samples. We're taking various methods to try to reach out to people differently. I mean, most polls now are doing some landlines for seniors, a lot of cell phones for young people. And we're also doing a lot of text to web where we can send someone a text and say, if you'd like to take a survey, go to this website and take the survey here. So most of us are using some combination of a multimodal strategy to try to overcome that. Ultimately, James, the proof is going to be in the pudding. We're going to find out if we've been successful. Yeah. But our polling in 2018 and 2022 was dead on the money. We're pretty good in 2020 as well. But it seems like Donald Trump is the real challenge. We don't have a problem doing a good poll when Donald Trump's not a part of the mix. But there are people who will vote for him who simply won't take our polls, and that's been the challenge for us.
So before I leave you, I've done a lot of posters, Democrat, Republican. I don't know if I'm sure there's some, but no one wants to get it wrong. I mean, they will not. I mean, I've known posters that love to come in and tell you bad news. Like, almost like Greenberg would get excited, you know, we're losing, guy. You know, I literally. But my experience, and Al, you probably the most experienced in conducting polls in journalism. I think 80% of the people in this industry really take pride in trying to get it right.
Oh, there's no question, James. I mean, if we don't get it right, our reputation suffers. And the best way to build our business is to get it right, not necessarily to pump up the side you happen to be working for. That doesn't do anybody any good.
Well, I'll just say this, picking up on James's point, at the Wall Street Journal for, 16 years, we had Peter Hart and Bob Teeter doing polls. Yep. You know they were two of the very, very best. We had one, maybe two polls that really weren't right. That's a pretty damn good percentage when we were doing 12 a year. But both times, you know, they agreed to throw one out. But God, they were reluctant to throw it out. I mean, they kind of knew it. And the same thing with one Ann Selzer poll at Bloomberg. She, too, is in the Whit Ayers, Peter Hart, Bob Teeter league. But James's point, they want to get it right. And they will reluctantly agree when they have one that just doesn't work, which happens.
Sure. And we have, We have done that. I mean, one out of 20 polls is just going to be screwy.
Right. Isn't that a mathematical certainty?
Of course, 95.
Yeah, I can't do the math, but people that can said it's a certainty. It's like gravity. One out of 20 has to be bad.
Right. 95 times out of 100, the true number is within plus or minus X percent of the number we're showing you.
Right.
That's 95%, but that means 5% of the time, it won't be. And most of us can see those polls because they just look off. They look off from everything else we've seen, from everything else that's out there. And we have thrown polls out and said to our client, I'm sorry, this is that one out of 20. And we go back and redo the poll. But that's part of being a pollster with some integrity, is recognizing those things and then being willing to throw it out and go back and do it again.
Yeah, I used to say a well-taken poll speaks to me. I can hear it when I'm reading it. It's talking to me.
It makes sense internally.
And then you would try to see one number and guess the next number. So if the direction of country was one thing, all right, then you would like to connect something else. Or party, self-described party ID was something else. You would try to link it to something else. And it really well-taken polls, which I've had the honor of seeing quite a few in my life. I've seen some bad ones. They talk to you when you're going through them. You're almost having a conversation.
They hang together.
Right.
They make sense. As you say, you see one number and you kind of know what the next number is going to be. And a good poll is internally consistent and makes sense to people who are experienced in the business.
That was that May 23 poll by Biden, and I kept looking, and it was actually worse than I thought. I started saying, okay, I'm trying to guess this number. It was fucking 10 points worse. And I'd say, guess this number. It was 10 points. That's when I said, we're not coming back from this. You have two candidates with 100% knowledge, and you can't, you know, you can say, oh, yeah, but Harris Wofford came from 40 back. That was different. No wonder who Harris was.
You're right.
These numbers were so bad. And I would tell people, you don't understand. They're much worse than you. It's not just that he's five down. They're not even listening to
it. Exactly. No, you were right on Biden's age all along. It is unfathomable to me that a year ago he didn't look at reality and get out and give the Democrats an opportunity to have a contest and may the cream rise. But he stubbornly hung on until he had no choice but to go with Harris.
And if Harris wins, he will be fine. He'll be judged for what he did as president, which I think will be pretty good. If Harris loses, he will go down as the guy who threw away this election by his stubbornness.
Yep, you're right.
I'll just make one other polling point. You know, you do adjust, you do adapt. If you have a lower percentage of women or a lower percentage or a higher percentage of blacks, you make some adjustments. One time I said to Ann Selzer, I think we have too many Democrats in this poll. I don't remember which party it was. And she said, I don't like to adjust for how people are self-identifying. I mean, that's their choice. I mean, it's not ours. It's different than. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I have a lot of respect for Ann. Right. She's a very fine pollster. But we know that party ID doesn't vary dramatically from one poll to the next. We know it can migrate a little bit, but you're not going to have 32% of Democrats in one poll and 40% in the next poll,
right,
and have both of them be right. Politics just doesn't work that way. And so if you don't adjust the one with 40% Democrats versus the 32, every number is going to be more Democratic by 8 points.
Right.
We know that. So, yeah, we do adjust. We adjust on an average of party ID over time to make sure you don't have one of those that is just wildly out of balance.
Well, we mentioned Ann Selzer and Stan Greenberg and Bob Teeter and Peter Hart, and in that pantheon of great pollsters, there's Whit Ayers too. So I can't.
Sure. I hope we can get you back, and you know, toward the end,
I'm happy to talk about this stuff anytime you want.
Well, we want, and we'll get back to you. Whit Ayers, thank you so much.
My pleasure, gentlemen. You have a good afternoon.
Will do.
You bet. Thank you.
Hey, James, our guest is one of America's premier historians on the presidency, Lindsay Chervinsky, historian at the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. Her new book, A Biography of John Adams and the Important Precedents the Nation's Second President Set for America. Dr. Chervinsky, first of all, it's a great honor to have you as our guest, and we want to talk about some of those important, one in particular, precedents. But first, your account of the crazy quilt election and political machinations of 1800 is riveting. The context, just briefly, after George Washington, after 8 years, Adams defeated Jefferson in 1796. They faced each other in 1800. Imagine a rematch. And it was a bitter contest. And after more than a month of voting, they ended up essentially tied. So it went to the House of Representatives. On the 36th ballot, the finalists were Jefferson and not Adams, but Jefferson's own vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr. God, that must have been unsettling for a new republic, Lindsay.
Yes, it was, I think, the first real constitutional crisis. And you know what? Let me start and say this. Thank you so much for having me. It is a delight to be with both of you. You are both icons, and I am a longtime listener, and it's just wonderful to be with you. But yes, 1800 was just a really calamitous moment. I know we'll talk more about it, but the threat of violence was so real, and the threat of it all completely falling apart was so tangible that I think sometimes because we know how it worked out, we downplay that threat in our minds, but they really didn't.
We want to talk about one of the maybe as important a precedent that Adams set. It was about the peaceful transfer of power. That was a bitter election, as you said. Both thought the other was a danger to the nation. Adams may have gotten a bad deal. He may have had cause to complain, to contest, or whatever. Yet he accepted, after the House vote, he accepted the outcome. And you noted he heartily wished Jefferson a prosperous administration. That was a really important thing, wasn't it?
It was. You know, I think he gets a little bit of the short end of the shrift because, well, first, he lost and he went home peacefully. That is a radical thing to do at any time. It is even more radical in the age of Napoleon, which was when he was living. So he lost, he accepted the outcome, he went home. I think he deserves applause for that. But he also set the terms of what that transition would be, in that he instructed his cabinet members to cooperate with Jefferson, to give him briefings so that he was sort of what we would think of as like intelligence reports. So he was up to date on what he would be walking into. He had him over to the White House so he could meet with some of the staff and see the building, and told him what, you know, carriages and horses belonged to the executive branch so he didn't have to overbuy. And those are actions that were not required. They were not written down. It was not mandated. And he did it anyway.
And at that time, those two really were bitter foes. They really disliked each other in 1800 and 1801. So this was something special. And you are a student of the presidency, and that critical precedent that you just alluded to, which helped define America, it held, didn't it, without exception for 220 years until Donald Trump 4 years ago.
It did. You know, I think it's really the bedrock of what it means to be a democracy, because all of the other things, you know, you can kind of quibble over the definitions. But if you don't have a transition that is decided at the ballot box and then carried out peacefully, it's something else. It's no longer a democracy. And so much of the nature of that transition isn't in the Constitution. It isn't required. And it takes repetition over decades and centuries to get American citizens to care about it, to cherish it, to uphold it. And you're right that, you know, I mean, the Civil War was kind of a weird anomaly, but even then, the South left because they accepted the outcome. They didn't contest the outcome. They accepted the outcome and they left. And so while certainly it wasn't an ideal transition, January 6th was a turning point in American history and was one of the things that really unlocked Adams' presidency for me.
James?
So, Prof, I read a little bit of it, reading your book, or read a previous book about Adams. I watched HBO thing or something. I kind of don't like him. What should I like him more than I do?
Yes, you should, for two reasons. One, okay. He was a little bit of a beloved curmudgeon, but we have to have a soft spot in our hearts for curmudgeons because then, you know, what else?
God, I'm everything against that.
The second part is so much of what we think of as the negative stuff that we think we know about Adams was actually brilliant propaganda that was written by Hamilton and Jefferson. They were the two all-time greatest propagandists in American history.
So they're like the lost cause.
Yeah, they were even better than that because no one even questions it. In fact, historians for centuries have taken what they wrote about Adams in the heat of a political environment when they were competing against him. They've taken that as truth to be accepted and not to be challenged. And it doesn't mean that there wasn't, you know, a little speck of truth in there, but it certainly should not be taken at face value. And so I think he actually was, you know, he had a brilliant wife that he adored. He was very funny. He was very self-deprecating, very aware of his own flaws, totally brilliant, committed to the Republic. And I think there's a lot there to really like.
And so, I mean, so take him in order. I understand he and Franklin didn't get along well.
That is true. They had a lot of respect for one another. The problem was that they were operating, they were both diplomats in France, and Adams was not well suited temperamentally to be a diplomat in France because he really didn't like that they didn't seem to work very hard. It really annoyed him that they seemed to just be having these parties and they started the day really late and they spent all this time in bed. And it was a very sort of intangible form of diplomacy that Franklin excelled at. When Adams went to the Netherlands and he was at The Hague, or even when he went to London, he did great because they got him. There was a cultural affinity there. But I think he and Franklin just were so different temperamentally that there was a little bit of oil and water. But it doesn't mean that he couldn't get along with people who were different than him. I mean, he and Jefferson actually were really pretty good friends for more of their life than they were not.
So before I turn back to, because this is, I guess I can't get out of it. He was kind of anti-immigrant, the Alien and Sedition Act. He was not a great civil libertarian. What's the defense of him? Why make me feel better about him?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And the Sedition Act is without a doubt the darkest mark on his presidency. I think it's worth noting. So first, all of that legislation, he didn't ask for any of it. He didn't try and, you know, curry votes for it or curry favor the Federalists in Congress. And this was at a time when Congress really was responsible for starting the legislation. It's not like the president was like, pass this bill. And so they passed the bill. He did sign it. He did accept the sedition prosecutions 100%. That's a dark mark. The alien piece, I think, is a little bit different because Congress passed a number of different bills that made it harder, basically, for immigrants to become citizens and to vote to try and undercut the political support of the Jeffersonian Republican Army. But they also gave Adams enormous authority to just deport immigrants at will, and he never used it. He never actually used that authority because he didn't think it was appropriate without due process. So I think that requires a little bit more nuance.
Before I turn it back to Al, so you listen to our show, you know Al and I. Who would we have voted for in 1800?
Oh, well, yeah, you probably would have voted for Jefferson. Okay. You probably would have voted for Jefferson.
All right, thank you, Prof. I love an honest answer. Go ahead, Al.
We always go for the pretty face, Lindsay, right? that's such a great question.
That's a great question.
Adams was a critical figure in the Revolution. A critical figure in the founding, the Declaration, Constitution, first president after Washington, the nation's icon. Yeah, he did a couple of bad things, as you mentioned, like the Sedition Act, but he just, you know, good things too, like the peaceful transfer. Yet history does not seem to place him in the pantheon of the extraordinary founders, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, even Hamilton. Do you think he should be?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, I think his presidency actually really belongs in the contributions he made. One of the biggest things he did was he knew how absolutely miserable it was going to be to follow Washington. Anyone who followed Washington was going to have a terrible time because they were going to absolutely fall short by comparison. And there were a lot of questions, especially foreign policy questions, that were starting to come up that were going to need to be resolved. And yet he did it anyway. He showed up. And I think that contribution is much less sexy than winning a civil war. It's much less exciting than winning World War II, but it matters and it's important. And, you know, he was instrumental in the Declaration of Independence. He ensured that Washington was in charge of the army. He signed a number of really critical treaties that kept the U.S. economy afloat and then defended American sovereignty. And then as president, he did the things we've talked about, peaceful transfer of power, showing up. But he also got the Treaty of Mortefontaine, which was signed in 1800, passed. And that ensured peace with the United States and France, which is the longest lasting, one of the longest lasting pieces in the United States.
Lindsay, is there, I hate asking this question, it shows my ignorance. Is there any Adams Memorial, any Adams Monument?
It's a great question. It's a really important one. Most people, when you know you ask that question, they'll say, well, there's the Adams building at the Library of Congress, which I don't think really counts because Jefferson also has a building and he also has a very large monument on the around the mall in the Tidal Basin. There is actually a commission in Congress right now to try and create an Adams family memorial, which I think is a really good way to look at it because they saw the revolution and independence and then the American Republic as a family project. And Adams' contributions would not be possible without Abigail's participation. She kept their life going, she raised their children, and she was his most important advisor. So I think seeing it as a family project is a really good way to go.
Yeah, let me try, you know, just one more before turning it back to James to close this, is you mentioned the treaty with France. I believe that was signed and when he was a lame duck. At the end of his term, it's a great model. What he accomplished after he had been defeated is a great model for Joe Biden today.
It is a great model. You know, he got the treaty signed and ratified, which was a challenge and actually took a lot of assistance from the Secretary of State, John Marshall. And he managed to get a new judiciary bill passed, which Jefferson called super political, but it was actually really important, and it created reforms that created basically the appellate level of the judicial system and is very similar to what we end up having today. He was careful about the transition. He was careful about the crisis of 1800, and he set the tone for what it meant to manage in a crisis, and I think that those are really important things and things worth applauding and studying for the current president.
James, you want to wrap this up?
So, Professor, when I look at Adams, what I know about him, he does not look like a revolutionary. Okay, he looks like his instinct is more establishmentarianism. What drove him over the line to be a revolutionary, and obviously a very kind of effective one, if you will? What was, because you don't think Jefferson, you can see him being a revolutionary. I mean, that wasn't hard.
Yeah.
Even Franklin, but Adams, I give him a lot of credit because I don't think that was his natural default position.
Well, he definitely wasn't instinctually super radical. You're right. I think that that's true. I think there are a couple of key attributes that made him a super devoted revolutionary. And early on, I mean, he was one of the earliest voices for independence in Congress and pretty essential in getting it passed. So the first was that he was incredibly principled and quite obstinate. And he did not mind doing something that was unpopular if he felt it was right. Perhaps that's ringing some bells for you gentlemen over the last couple of months. So he really didn't mind, you know, and this first comes up with he decided to represent the British soldiers after the Boston Massacre because right. He wanted to demonstrate that the colonies were trying to be a place where principles really mattered. It wasn't a mob rule society. It was a place where the rule of law was important and the revolution they were talking about was based on the rule of law. And so I think that obstinacy, that sense of righteousness, the sense of principles and right and wrong was really important to him. I also think that he cannot be understood separate from his New England Puritan roots. He had great pride in being a New Englander, being a multi-generation New Englander. He was a man of Harvard. And so there was a great deal of independent spirit and pride in that background that clashed with the idea that they were somehow less than the British homeland or other British subjects. They had a lot of pride in being New Englanders and, you know, really would have resented being told they were second class.
Okay. So, this is my suggestion, Adams' legacy. They should take a major building and name it after. Is the executive office building have a name, Albert?
It's the Eisenhower building, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, just take something and name it after it and then use it as a rabbinical teaching moment to tell a country how sacred this peaceful transfer of power is.
Yeah.
Because as good as your book is, and one more question before I go. When I was reading your book, it struck me, I always thought that foreign policy back then, hell, you had the Indians to the west and you had the Atlantic Ocean and there wasn't much in between. And that is decidedly not true. They had they had to really manage some kind of sticky foreign policy issues, didn't they?
They really did. You know, not only was foreign policy quite present because there was constantly the threat of war with France, Spain, Great Britain, but foreign policy was the primary responsibility of the federal government and the expectation that the president would spend the majority of their time on foreign policy. And of course, the president is really the only person responsible for foreign policy. So Adams spent the majority of his presidency trying to figure out how to keep the United States neutral because he understood how essential trade and intellectual commerce was to the future of the United States, and that war would destroy that.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Albert. Close.
Well, I hope everyone out there will get Lindsay Chervinsky's biography of John Adams and the important precedents that he set. It really is a terrific book. We're so glad you joined us. I must tell you, James, I am lobbying her for her next book. I want her to do her next book, which she hasn't ruled out, on Grant and Eisenhower. And I think it could be a fabulous book because, you know, she's one of the great historians in our country. So, Lindsay, I'm going to keep after you on this one.
I appreciate it. I really like the support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor. And I hope if we can come back on and, you know, give us some historical markers as we enter this pretty uncertain time, to say the least.
Anytime. Always glad to join you guys.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hey, now, James, for the outrage of the week. Every place abortion has been on the ballot or is an issue, Democrats have won. Although New York State has abortion protections, proponents wanted to make sure that the issue wasn't taken for granted, so they put it on the ballot as a constitutional amendment this November. But a Politico story this week was jarring. First of all, the left insisted that some other provisions be added to it, like LGBTQ protections, which I'm all for, but it should be considered separately. Now Republicans are duplicitously arguing this measure is all about trans rights. And inexplicably, the state Democratic Party isn't putting any real resources, according to Politico, behind this referendum, which was intended to energize turnout. You know, in Kansas, Ohio, Kentucky, among others, all resoundingly approved abortion rights measures. If it falters in New York, it's because the New York State Democratic Party and the state produces some outstanding federal officials like, you know, Hakeem Jeffries. But the New York State Democratic Party is a near disaster. And if they screw this one up, they really deserve all the blame they can get.
Yeah, there's so many factions. It's always been a state party at war with itself.
Right.
You know, my outrage is the whole pro-life movement. Okay, I grew up cradle Catholic. I don't know how many sermons I've listened to about, it's plain and simple, abortion is murder. They had the Human Life Amendment. They were adamant. They presented themselves as having the moral high ground, that there was a real sense of what was right and what was wrong. And at a time, you could say, well, I disagree with them, but you got to at least give them the fact that they're principled people, that they really believe this, and that this is very much part of who they are. And when you watch all of the back and forth and, you know, 16 weeks, or should we have six, or should we have this, and they've just exposed themselves is just a pack of hypocrites that are trying to save themselves politically. And I don't know how many human right amendments have been in the Republican Party platform, how many sermons have been given on Sunday morning, and they just quit. And it's like, well, okay, well, if you got to be for 12 weeks, that's fine. Or you need exceptions, that's fine. All right. And maybe there's an element of political practicality there. Who is James Carville to criticize somebody for being politically practical or politically expedient? But that's not that's not the way you've ran your business here for the last 50 years. You ran it as this, that you were some moral superior, moral high ground. And it turned out you're not on the high ground. You're just in a sludge pit with everybody else.
Yeah, excellent point. Hey, and now for our always great questions from our listeners. James, I just love this first one. This is one of the all-time greats. Susan in Washington, D.C. says, I am starting to finish James's sentences before he does. Is there some sort of self-help group I can join? Does Mary Madeline provide some Zoom counseling?
Well, all I can tell you is watch the documentary. It'll be on CNN on October 5th, and you can see a lot of Mary. And that's very complimentary. Thank you for saying that. But I think what you're telling me, sometimes my thoughts are consistent, and that's a very high compliment.
That is a high. And we'll check with Mary about whether she provides any Zoom counseling, Susan. Gordon in Norwood, Michigan says, fact checkers are bending over backwards to classify Dem talking points on Project 2025 and abortion as misleading. What gives? Well, first of all, Gordon, fact checking, I think, had more value 20 years ago or so. But Donald Trump told how many tens of thousands of lies?
I think it's in the 30s.
Yeah, he was fact-checking, and it didn't matter. He doesn't care. He has proven that you can just run roughshod over fact-checkers. I still think I'd still rather have them than not have them. But they do bend over backwards. And so, therefore, if there are 10 statements made, and Trump lies about 8, and the Democrats exaggerate about 2, and you have a 50-50, that really is not good journalism. But you know, I think Trump has really hurt, if not ruined, the fact checking industry.
Well, so let's take the fact checking industry. And let me tell you something, and I defy anyone to disagree on this. By 5-1, they would rather fact check a misleading Democratic claim. Because Republicans have so many, so they want to pay. Right. Look, we're just umpires, man. We just call it like you see it. We don't really have anything. And of course, there are times when Democrats exaggerate or use. But this is my thing is, how would you fact check World War II? How would you fact check Tojo and Roosevelt? How would you fact check Yamamoto in Nimitz? All right. Would you just say, well, down the line, he made a mistake here, but, you know, he said that, or he was deceptive, or, you know, Tojo really came from more humble backgrounds than Roosevelt? No. And they're treating this like this is just a normal time where you got to, you know, shirts and skins, and we just call them like we see them. And I think the whole industry has to decide, what is our role here? Is our role to be objective, impartial observers that report as accurately and fairly as we can? Or is our role here to try to help save the Constitution of the United States? Because they're two different things.
Yeah. And you need to ask, how would you fact check Lincoln and Jefferson Davis?
Yeah, how do you fact check? Well, you know, Davis was actually Secretary of Defense. He was in the United States Senate. He was actually more qualified than Lincoln. I think by any measure, in the late 1850s, Jefferson Davis had more quality. Lincoln was only a one-term congressman. So the fact checkers would say, well, yeah, he's been one-term congressman. He's a very good orator. But and this guy's been a very respected, I think he was defense secretary, and he was a very important United States senator. He certainly had a nuance and deeper background than Lincoln did. That's the way these motherfuckers would do it today.
Yeah.
They'd have to go out of their way to, you know, well, you know, Yamamoto was a, you know, gambler. He liked to play roulette and, you know, his logistical genius. And his finger was shot off at Tsushima. There's all kind of good things. You could, if the fact checker today would find give you something to like about Yamamoto and something to dislike about Nimitz.
Yeah.
It's not a fact check.
James, some of our listeners like to jump ahead. Pete in Raleigh, North Carolina says, when the writing is on the wall on election night and Harris is elected, should she call Trump and tell him she'll get his criminal charges dropped if he concedes the election, congratulates her, and promises never to go back on it again?
No.
Yeah.
And you cannot negotiate. I mean, the peaceful transfer of power is not a negotiable thing in the United States.
Right.
Now, she may
say... Wouldn't matter what he says anyway.
He wouldn't keep his word. You know, but, she, you know, maybe she'll think it's in the best interest of the country to pardon him. I don't think she will. And she'd have to certainly give... You would want her to get good reasons. But I don't think you can say, if you accept the law, I'll do this for you. No.
Right. If he gets a pardon, it should be A, with very, very, very tough conditions, monetary and political, and it should be right on the eve of him going to the slammer.
Right.
And that's the only way, and that's debatable. Mary in Ballycolleen, Ireland.
Oh, wow.
Boy, it's good to have, huh?
Oh, from the old country.
The native soil says, what are your views on Harris's chances in Pennsylvania and why is she devoting so many resources to places like Georgia when it looks like Pennsylvania will be the key to winning? Well, first of all, Mary, I'm going to tell you that I lost a bet to Paul Begala in 2016 when I bet with confidence that Pennsylvania would go for Hillary Clinton. I was wrong. But I placed another bet the other day. Pennsylvania will be with Harris. I know the polls are very close. But if you look at the state and you look at the demographics of the state and the population of the state and the growth areas of the state, which are those four huge Philadelphia suburbs, cast more votes than Pittsburgh and Philadelphia put together, she will do probably even better than Biden did last time with that population growth. She'll do a little bit better in Philadelphia with the black vote, may do almost as well in Allegheny. And the rest of the state, which James has called Alabama, Trump may do a little bit better, but not a lot. And I think when you put that all together, I really would much rather have her hand in Pennsylvania than his.
Well, I would have to say the poll in Pennsylvania is a little stubborn. All right? Some spate of them came out here recently. And yeah, I think it's more, I mean, I think you're probably right at the end. I'd rather be her, but not by a lot. But I want to address the question about resources. They have so much money, they gave $25 million to House and Senate candidates. You have to be able to compete in Pennsylvania and Georgia at the same time. You have to be able to compete in Wisconsin and Arizona at the same time. You have to be ready to compete in Michigan and Nevada, North Carolina, which I'm big on, at the same time. I mean, it's only seven. I actually think there's eight, but I'm one of the very few people that do. But I mean, there's seven classical swing states here, and you got to be in all of them. And you have the resources to do it. You got a vice presidential candidate that all of the congressional candidates are clamoring to come in. Walz is way more hotter item to campaign with congressional candidates than even Harris is.
Right.
Which they've got a lot of resources. You know,
they do. James, I think the only time where a choice is necessary is probably in the closing weeks with candidate time. But certainly you're right. They can certainly spend, you know, they can spend it all in Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Nevada, as well as the blue wall.
Yeah, you can fly from Pittsburgh to Savannah in 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just you got resources and I don't. You know, where you pick individual, look, if you go to Pennsylvania, do you campaign in Philadelphia to try to get traditional Democratic constituents out? Do you campaign in maybe York or Erie or I don't know? I mean, it's not just where you, the state you show up in, it's where you show up in the state you show up in.
That's true. James, Ray in Donaldsonville, Louisiana. Where's Donaldsonville?
Donaldsonville is where I went to high school.
Oh, my gosh.
It's about, I don't know, 17 miles downriver, but it's a West Bank town. it's a bold, at one time was like the Louisiana capital. It's a town, a place with an interest in history, and I graduated from Ascension Catholic in Donaldsonville, Louisiana. Yes.
Well, Ray asks, he notes that Democrats have been successful in Georgia by registering more young and black voters, and he wants to know, are there any organized efforts being made in Louisiana and Mississippi to do the same?
There's always some, but I would say this, and although I'm very much of a Louisianan at heart, I think Mississippi might be a more fruitful place down the road in Louisiana. Its black population is, I think ours is like 33 or second, but they're like 38 and a half, 39 in terms of raw population. And, but they could be more, but some of the registration figures I see are actually pretty encouraging around the country. It was some doubt before, but not so much anymore.
Pick up on your point about Mississippi. My son's candidate, Brandon Presley, only lost that governor's race by less than 3 points.
Right.
That's not a landslide, and that's, you know, it's probably not there now, but it could be there, you know, 4 or 5 years from now.
It could. It all depends if they got to field some really good candidates. But in Louisiana, you know, we had John Bell, who was once in a lifetime political figure who had. Yeah. Very good fortune of having really, really, I think at the end of the day, kind of weak opponents. I mean, David Bitter was, you know, had a lot of issues, and that Rasponi guy that ran against him in 2017.
Right. John in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, said, I hope both of you were stuck in D.C. during 2006, I think I know what he's getting to, because my daughter takes after you two more than me. It's her first time voting, and she wanted to kick off the election by seeing Politics War Room live in New York City on the 19th of September. Unfortunately, we can't make it. Did we miss our chance? You know, 2006, as big believers in our democracy and Constitution, I think, James, I would advise us to take the fifth on that. But I want to tell John something. You're in luck. You'll miss Manhattan on the 19th. But James and I have a live show in Boston at the Schubert Theater the week of the election, November 2, 3 days before the election. And, you know, it's not that bad a drive or train ride up to Boston. So you and your daughter, John, can do it. The energy is going to be crazy. What about it, James, with us there?
I think I'm excited. Boston's such a great city. It's easily accessible. I promise you we're going to have a great program. It'll be lively. It'll be interesting. And, you know, hopefully we can, even that late in the cycle, can break some new turf here. We're going to try to, for sure.
3 days before the election, I can't imagine a more exciting time and a more appropriate place than Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
We want everyone listening to join us on the tour during the final stretch. You're going to rally the troops, hear from a special guest, and it's going to be a celebration of Kamala Harris's upcoming win. All you have to do is go to politicon.com/tour and get your tickets for November 2 at the Schubert Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, don't wait. They're going fast. We want to see as many of you there as we can. So head to politicon.com/tour now to get your tickets. We'll see you in Boston, November 2.
Come see us in Beantown.
Hey, James, Brian in Long Island City, New York, says Republicans have asked why Kamala didn't implement her presidential plans and policies during this administration. What's the best response? Brian, she was vice president. Vice presidents don't implement policies. They follow presidential policies. They may advise, but you didn't hear of Biden policies during the Obama years. You know, exception might be Dick Cheney, but that's rare. And, I think that she can easily adapt and has and promote some new policies. But, you know, you can't, you can say that she was involved in an administration that you thought had bad policies. I don't agree with that, but you can't say she should have implemented her own policies during the last 3.5 years.
I agree 100%. And I wrote today, she's got to tell us what she wants to do. I mean, you can't run saying I'm going to be just like the last person.
Right.
And no one's ever done that, to be fair. Bush maybe in 88 a little more than, you know, most people, but
yeah,
that's about it.
James, our last question is almost as good as our first question that was from Susan, who's finishing your sentences and needs to have a, you know, some kind of merry Zoom call. This is Alan in Worcester, Massachusetts, who says, my wife is pregnant with our first child due in December. What is one piece of advice you would give to all new dads or parents? And how would you suggest teaching our kids about becoming interested in participating in politics and civic affairs?
Well, I've always had this theory. In modern times, when you get married, your life doesn't change much between you and your wife. The first kid, it switches because she bears the burden of having a child, of taking care of it. And so it's like you do something. You know, I'm doing all the work here. And it's, you know, I don't know. The only thing I try with my little grandson, to the extent that I get to spend time with him, is just be curious. And if you're curious, everything else will follow. I know plenty of smart people that are not successful. I know plenty of people who are not that smart who are pretty successful. But I don't know of, unless it's some kind of math prodigy or something like that. All successful people I know have one thing in common. They're really curious. And if you can just have that kind of environment, I think everything will be fine.
Alan, two bits of advice. This is it's different. Our first child was born over 40 years ago. And someone said to me when Judy was, I don't know, 5 or 6 months pregnant, go see all the movies you can. And I thought, what's talking about? This is when we went out to a movie theater. And the answer was that once your child's born, yeah, you'll get a babysitter when you have to go out for a dinner party or an engagement. But you're more reticent if you want to go out and see a movie. Now, it's a little bit different today with so much on the home screen. But theaters or whatever have you, your life's going to change. And so just think of how it changes. And the second, as far as interested in politics and civic affairs, I spent the weekend with my 6.5-year-old grandchild, and he asked a question about Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. Didn't know very much, and we had a wonderful half-hour conversation. And I'm not going to say that he is a James Carville now when it comes to knowledge of politics, but he was interested. And I think maybe we whetted his appetite some. So talk to your kids about this.
Yeah, the other thing I'll tell you, when my sister had her first baby, but she came out to the living room, my mother said, you have to understand, you can only be as happy as your child is.
Oh, boy.
So if your child is not happy, you're not going to be happy. And it's just the way it is. Your self-happiness and the way you feel about things is going to be more determined. You know, we can gut through it. Our wife is not happy, but if we have an unhappy child, it really, really drags us down. But it's a great experience too. When they're happy, you get really happy too.
You know, there was the famous New Yorker cartoon about a New Yorker's view of the world, and First Avenue to 10th Avenue was about 95% of the map. And then it went to, I think, Wichita and then New Delhi, which was 5%. Well, that's what your life's going to be like. Before the child, it's going to be Wichita, New Delhi, and afterwards, it'll be First Avenue to 10th Avenue.
I remember that cartoon, and I thought it was great. Actually, it was great, and maybe too much truth to it sometimes.
Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Now remember, get your tickets for the Politics War Room Tour, live appearances. James and I are bringing the podcast to you live on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th with our guest, NBA great and former United States Senator Bill Bradley. The Variety Playhouse in Atlanta on October the 12th and Boston Schubert Theater on November the 2nd, 3 days before the election. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Mint Mobile, and 3-Day Blinds, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts,
Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.